Do we? Yes, we do seem to have some kind of sound. Try to boost the volume a little bit. Gain. Let's see if that works. I think that works. Yeah. All right. It is the 17th of November. The podcast will be updated shortly on the website. And we are going to discuss data protection and data breach tonight. A little multimedia happening too. So before I do that, though, one of the things I just passed out was a revised syllabus, since with the missed class, things are shifting. So here's how we're going to do this. Next class, remember, a week from tonight, we appropriately give thanks. And you can give thanks that you're not here, but you're with your families. We have 2 days that are statutory Thursdays. And hopefully that won't be a problem for your collective schedules. So our next meeting is actually the 29th, which is one of those statutory Thursdays. On that day, we'll do the first part of the workplace issues discussion. On the 1st, which is our regular Thursday meeting, I'm going to combine the topics that were shown on the syllabus originally as workplace 2 and 3. So we're going to do 2 days rather than 3 on workplace privacy issues. On the 6th, which is another one of those joyful statutory Thursdays, we're going to look briefly at issues of cybercrime and law enforcement. And I'm leaving all of the 8th to review and questions, to really try to bring it all together and then answer any questions that you have. Before the 8th, I will be giving you more materials so you can start thinking about them, your questions. The international privacy overview, which I would like you to have and which could conceivably show up on an exam, will be done at around that time as a recorded class. And then, of course, the exam remains the same. So this is how we're going to rejigger what we have the remaining time to ensure that we have sufficient review time particularly. Questions that seem to work for people? Okay, good. All right. Let's talk about data protection and breach. And on the one hand, they're two very different topics. On the other hand, they're clearly related. Oops. In this, we have both technical requirements and legal requirements. And sometimes the legal requirements mandate technology. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they mandate process. And they don't necessarily say how to achieve that process. The law may say, for example, as we'll see, and as we have seen, this particular type of information should not be left for general access. It should be access should be restricted to these specific people or these specific roles for this specific purpose. That is a legal requirement. If then it would say it must have a password of X complexity or the data must be stored in an encrypted fashion, that's when we have technological requirements. These types of concepts of both mandates for protection and obligations on breach, that is, if the protection fails, what happens? To perhaps use a less than appropriate metaphor, the morning after question. What do you do if it didn't work? So these issues cross over industries and contexts and everything else, but of course, where we have specific industries, where we have specific vulnerabilities and sensitivities, we see additional obligations and additional concerns. And what we're talking about is, on the one hand, risk mitigation, reducing the chance that bad things happen. And on the other hand, What kind of response must we see when bad things happen? Consider, both of these challenges are relatively new. As with all of the digitally stored information, this hasn't been such a big deal until relatively recently. Note, though, that the breach notification is a very recent phenomenon. That even though the issues of data protection have gone back, it is only in the last 5 to 6 years or so that the laws have begun to require telling victims when data about them has been taken, has been lost, has been altered. So before that, it was really, did you notice or not? It isn't a new problem. I have a friend, I know this is so surprising. I have a friend who has served to be a source of wonderful good examples. She and I started practicing about the same time in the same firm, where we remain friends a couple of decades later, which is very cool. But for the longest time, my friend, whose name happens to be Sherry F. London, you can look her up, she's very distinguished, she had problems obtaining any sort of major credit. Because every time she would apply, the bank or the lender, whatever, would tell her about some problems in a file of a Sherry E. London, whose social security number happened to be 2 digits away. My friend was a victim, a very early victim, because of course she is a very advanced person, very early victim of identity theft. And in the low-tech credit reporting and checking process of really 15, 20 years ago, she kept having to explain that she wasn't Sherry E. London. She was Sherry F. London, and that this other person had used her identity and screwed up credit. So it's not a new problem. But my friend found this out because when she went to apply for a mortgage or other sort of major loan, she would be faced with this. Not because she was told. Then, more recently, there was then the intermediate step of the entitlement to credit reports. That we as Americans, by federal law, have the right to request once a year, free. You don't need to go to freecreditreport.com or whatever other thing. You have the right to go to the 3 major credit reporting agencies and ask for your credit report. But there, too, that's proactive. You have to be proactive. You have to ask for it and then read through it and figure it out. And only recently have we seen this development of affirmative obligations to notify victims. And we'll get into those a little later on. So let's start with data protection. Here, too, technology and technique. Records that are stored electronically are vulnerable to both damage and malicious intrusion. They are more fragile in some ways than are paper records. Both can be damaged by fire or flood, but paper doesn't care if you wave a magnet over it, and so on. Very hard to lose a warehouse. Very easy to lose a hard drive. It's also more difficult to change paper records. Sure, it can be done, but it's difficult to do all of them at once. Whereas electronically stored data can be altered. Why would anyone alter electronically stored data? Why would someone maliciously, not steal it, but change it? Where's the benefit? That's what I like. You guys are just... You know what? There's something to that. There is a certain, and when I use the expression hacking, I always try to modify it with malicious hacking. Because there is a culture firmly enmeshed within the technological society of hacking to show it can be done. It's kind of the technical equivalent of Fraternity Rock. You guys know what Fraternity? I think that's what they call it. You're going down the Jersey Turnpike, just past the Meadowlands going south. There's a giant boulder that they must have blasted through to make the turnpike, covered with fraternity logos in paint. Could not have been easy. Yeah. Graffiti back before you could, but back before subway trains couldn't be painted on. And you still see it, right? What is the notion of tagging? What's the idea? The idea is to show it can be done and that you did it. And there really is a culture of technologists who break into systems, exploit vulnerabilities, not for damage, not for political purposes, simply to show it can be done. Sometimes so that the people who run the systems will close them off. There's a hackers convention every year. There are a couple of them, but there's sort of a famous one. And one of the things that this hackers convention has is a wall of shame. What's the wall of shame? While you're at the convention, if you make the mistake of logging into any account you have on the wireless network in the clear, without encryption, they'll put your name and your password up on a wall, because you should know better. So yeah, there is a culture, as you say, for shits and giggles.
Kicks and giggles.
I'm sorry. Okay. Your language is much cleaner than mine. We're going to edit that out, right? Of changing just to change. Why? What could a malicious intrusion do? Consider, for example, the UPS delivery database. Change the destination of packages. You don't have to steal any data. Just get in, change the destination, and oh look, stuff's starting to show up. That's easy. Well, it's not easy for me. But it's a minor change in the sense of things, right? Just have to change the routing information. Think of, all those Ocean's movies when they get in and they alter things. Think about someone who, instead of stealing your identity, changes the credit card record so that her billing address is the actual billing address, not yours. So the intrusion can, in fact, be damaging. Or you look at Stuxnet. You know what Stuxnet is? The Stuxnet worm? The Iranians do. Their nuclear power plants, or nuclear whatever plants, sure do. This was a worm that was designed to go to affect very, very specific types of computing systems that were used, not incidentally, to control centrifuges. Centrifuges that are used to spin and enrich uranium and cause them to spin in all sorts of ways they're not supposed to and break. And the Iranians found that all of their nuclear centrifuges controlled by this were not working right. Take a look. Stuxnet. STUX, I think it was called that. So there are a lot of possibilities. Damage to malicious intrusion. But it doesn't have to be so complicated. Electronic storage in place has to be broken into. Electronic storage taken out of place can be looked at in leisure. You drop your phone, you lose your computer, the laptop is stolen, a hard drive is stolen. So the data protection is not just where it sits, that is, while it's in where it's supposed to be, and how are those data stored, and how is access controlled, but data protection also involves when data move, either through transmission or physically. Sometimes it's not just the machines you're using now. It's machines you used to use. As with this story from last month. Security research have found personal records of Sun newspaper and, I don't know what MOD staff is, on the hard drives of discarded or resold computers. CSRI, the Cybersecurity Research Institute, did a study of used computers. British businesses and households are throwing away a staggering 15.1 million gigabytes of data a year on old computers, according to a new study. The report that says that an unwiped hard drive belonging to News Corp was later sold to a third party. The hard drive contained the home addresses and mobile phone numbers of the entire staff of the Sun, plus other high-profile individuals, including then-Sun editor Rebecca Wade, Andy Coulson, and Top Gear presenter and News International columnist Jeremy Clarkson. 30% of the drives currently making their way onto the secondhand market had data on them. You buy a used computer off eBay, you may find yourself buying someone's bank records or personal photos or so on. USB sticks, we're just carrying around warehouses. So it's a real problem. And note, companies do not only need to worry about the criminals, it says here. Carelessness can now cost far more than the fines that can be levied by the Information Commissioner, that's the UK, the FSA, and credit card companies. Over the Paul McCartney story, I was told the reputational loss was estimated by Deutsche Bank to be between 10 and 12 million pounds. That's a reputational loss. Plus, there's a cost to deal with the problem. So it's not an unfamiliar problem. Now, so we have computers sitting in places. We have portable storage devices. We have thrown out computers. And then we have computers that are connected to the world. Either because they're connected to the internet or because the storage devices themselves are located out there. Like Dropbox, as we've seen, right? Dropbox, cloud-based storage, it's not computer, it's just storage. It was open. Lots of these cloud-based, Apple now had just launched the iTunes something, which I don't really think is cloud-based storage. I think it's an actual older idea. That is, the software checks what you already have on your machine and then gives you access to the same recording that's sitting up someplace, basically like some giant jukebox where you get to listen to the songs you already own if you're connected. But you have lots of these remote storage things. And so not only can you or a customer or a business get access to them, but someone else can as well. And so the requirements are there because it's not just about theft again, but it's integrity, as we see from this very important documentary about the risks of data integrity in education and the military.
David Lightman was a master at computer games. A fast thinker.
Oh, David! Maybe you can tell us who first suggested the idea of reproduction. seduction without sex.
Your wife.
Watch this. Educational data integrity problems.
Those are great.
Yeah.
I don't think that I deserve that.
Do you?
I'm in jail for that.
Only if you're over 18.
This computer company is coming out with these amazing new games in a couple of months.
And I want to play those games.
Wow.
What?
You got something.
He found the right code word to play the game.
We're in.
But it was the wrong computer.
Shall we play?
Bad idea. Bad idea. They're all so young. You've all seen War Games, right? All right. Okay, we get the idea. I would hope everybody should see that movie. It's a wonderful movie, dated as hell. I remember reading, though, that the equipment that David Lightman had in his little bedroom was hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of devices, big floppy disks, right? But you want to talk about an illustration of the challenges of data protection? Do you remember how he got in? It wasn't too far off. His computer dialed every number in the area. The ones that were computers, they would connect to. And then he would try various password exploits. Now, yeah, it's Hollywood. He got in awfully fast, and somehow the computer in Cheyenne Mountain was connected out to the world
through a modem.
Through a modem, right? And he just happened to have this nice little vocoder so he could talk like this, you know. But there it is, data integrity. But before he almost destroyed the world, you know, there's like a remake of War Games, which is really cheesy, but it's supposedly a sequel, fairly recent sequel. I think I saw it on some plane. It was icky. But anyway, this is the good one. But what did he do before he almost blew up the world? He broke into his school, changed Ali Sheedy's grade, right, to a B, and then to a D, and then to a B again or something. So what a wonderful encapsulation of issues of data protection, or lack thereof. He didn't have to break into Cheyenne Mountain, although he managed to get in there eventually. He didn't have to break into the admissions office of the school, or rather the grade office. His computer did the walking. There's some really interesting legal and ethical questions that arise sort of in this context. And as an aside, I will pose to you the following situation, which happened a few years ago. A number of MBA programs were using a particular web-based application program. They also used the same one, and applicants would get a registration number and apply to the schools and wait to see what happens. Someone discovered that a particular page, which was not a page that you would click on, but if you typed in an address and added to the address your own particular login, your own particular identifying number, you could see the status of your application. There was no password hacking. It was just there. And if you put your number in, you got yours. So someone posted this on a Business Week MBA program discussion board. A number of students did it. When the business schools found out, they actually rejected, MIT rejected students, I think Harvard, for basically ethical violations, as if they had hacked into the system. They didn't, in the sense, on the one hand, They access data that they were not, in theory, supposed to see. On the other hand, it was a perfectly open page. If you knew the address, you didn't have to fake a password. It was right there on the internet. It was a poorly designed system. So, what do you think? Would that be considered breach of data protection? Personally, would you see that as hacking? Would you see that as unethical to go in and check out that information that was not public?
Bad security.
Right. It was clearly bad security. Those who took advantage of it, what do you think? Ethical, unethical, problematic, would it be considered hacking in your mind? Malicious hacking?
No?
Why not? The schools thought so.
If they're looking into their own...
If you're walking down the halls of a school you'd applied to, and the admissions office door was open and there were files on the desk, and you walked in and looked at it, would that be ethical?
No.
Is it any different?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So those of you who say, you guess not, then it's unethical. How do you guys check your grades?
Online
where? Anybody check them through the college website? You guys know about that? You know what I'm talking about? What's the deal with that?
Well, that's what we do now. We go to the editorial website, the editorial college.
But are those the official grades?
Well, it's an unofficial transcript.
I see. How did you know about that?
Now the school actually tells you to go there to get your grades.
Okay, that may be true now. It wasn't until recently. It was very much the same situation. The official place that you were supposed to look for your grades was on the Touro Law website. But since we share systems with the college, it was well known among the student body that you could get your grades in advance before the law school reported them through the college's website. Right? How is that any different? I used to really bother my cyber law class with this. My cyber crime class, because it really isn't. But in both, what you're talking about here is data protection. That in all of these circumstances, from David Lightman's high school to the Whopper in Cheyenne Mountain, I'll come up with some sort of cute war operation, something or other, Whopper, right? To the business school admission services, to the Touro College grade server. What you have there is a failure of data protection. Enabling, I should say, unauthorized access. What's the response? How does the issue, the challenge of data protection, get addressed? One way is through physical access restrictions. That certain data must be locked away, must be kept from public view. When we talked about HIPAA, you'll recall, I hope, that, and we looked at the enforcement, remember we looked at some of the HIPAA enforcement cases. And one of them had to do with a physician's office where, because of the way the desks were, patients could see other patients' records on the screens of the receptionists. And what was one of the things that the enforcement agency, the I guess it was the Office of Civil Rights of Health and Human Services, required? Screen protectors. So that you had to be right next to the screen in front of it. If you went off to the side, it was no longer visible. We do that in the analog world too. The curtain in the old voting machines. The minimal little thingy now that they put in front of your the desk that you circle your new ballots. That's data protection, physical access. HIPAA very specifically talks about physical access requirements, password protection, etc. Encryption is an interesting one, though. We all think about now encryption, the idea of scrambling the data, as an industry standard, and it is. It absolutely is. But 15 years ago, encryption technology was classified as munitions, things that blow up, under federal law. And it was a federal crime akin to exporting prohibited weapons to export encryption technology. To the point where, now this, you can look it up. Web browsers. Web browsers come with and have come with for a very long time built-in encryption technology, not for storage. Did the jet engine just turn on? Pilot light lit? I don't know. There's that sort of almost that low rumble. I'm sorry. We're talking about weapons, and it sounded like a rocket just launched. So your web browser encrypts transmissions point to point. That's how you can feel confident that when you're logged in to what is actually your bank's website, not a fake one, that even if someone could tap the line, they can't read the transmission. There are different levels of that encryption based on the size of the potential, the number of potential keys, digital keys. It's expressed in powers of two. 40-bit encryption is 2 to the power of 40, 2 to the 40th, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 260, all the way down, right? Number of keys, it's a lot. 128-bit encryption is 2 to the 128th, which is not only a little more than double as complex as 2 to the 40th, it's a lot. There was a point in the mid-90s, when this encryption law remained true, that it was illegal for Netscape or Microsoft to export versions of their browser software that functioned with 128-bit encryption. It was illegal. It was like they were shipping bombs. And when the first users of the Netscape browser, when they first put in this SSL, the secure socket layer encryption, you had to attest that you were in the United States before you were permitted to download the version with 128-bit encryption. And the same was true for Internet Explorer. The way the law was written, though, made for some very unusual situations, incidentally. People who found this law to be ridiculous, because of course nothing was stopping people in other countries from developing sophisticated encryption. So people would take an encryption algorithm, put it on a t-shirt, and try to leave the country. That was illegal. By the way, when they first broke the DVD encryption scheme, when DVD John published this DECSS software, which is a little bit out of the scope of this, and again, he was soundly sued for publicizing this trafficking in this encryption technology. Once again, people printed up t-shirts with this very simple set of code that was this encryption technology. ultimately, I think it was a researcher named, if I'm remembering correctly, Zimmerman. I need to check that. Who wrote a paper, an academic paper, about encryption. And in the course of the academic paper about encryption, he talked about the algorithms. And he was prohibited from publishing. And he sued under First Amendment grounds, and he won. So because of that, and because of just the march of technology, this is no longer the case, obviously. Encryption technology is well shared. It is commonplace throughout the world. It's not a munition anymore under federal law. And not only is it encouraged, but certain situations it is required that data that are stored be stored in an encrypted fashion. We've seen some examples of this. Remember the BJ wholesale case that I think troubled Francis particularly? I just remember that conversation. Do you guys remember this? So let's go back to the FTC and let's see what the FTC had to say about it. FTC.gov/privacy, thank you. Redirect, case highlights, go to B. Oof. And here we are, bless you. So June 16th, 2005. In the matter of BJ's Wholesale Club. BJ's Wholesale Club was sued by the Federal Trade Commission under Article 5 Consumer Protection Statute, remember? Because it had failed to take appropriate security measures to protect the sensitive information of thousands of its customers, and that was deemed an unfair practice that violated federal law. And not incidentally, opened BJ's up to allowing theft of credit cards and millions of dollars of unauthorized purchases. So the settlement will require BJ's to implement a comprehensive information security program and obtain audits by an independent third-party professional every other year for 20 years. So what was its failure? It failed to encrypt consumer information when it was transmitted or stored, created unnecessary risks to the information by storing it up to 30 days in violation of bank security rules, store the information in files that could be accessed using commonly known default user IDs and passwords, failed to use readily available security measures to prevent unauthorized wireless connections, and failed to use measures sufficient to detect unauthorized access to the networks. We talked about this. These were not legally required. They weren't. They aren't, generally speaking. But yet, the FTC still managed to convince BJ's that it merited settling the case because it did not encrypt the data in transmission or storage, and it kept it for 30 days. This is the trend. There is a trade group called the PCI, Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard. The payment card industry has set up its own self-regulatory standard with regard to encryption. It's a contractual obligation. This is not statute. This is not regulation. The Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard, PCI DSS, is a set of requirements designed to ensure that all companies that process, store, or transmit credit card information maintain a secure environment. It was launched on September 7, 2006. It's administered and managed by this security standards group, an independent body that was created by the major payment card brand. It is important to note the payment brands and acquirers are responsible for enforcing compliance, not the PCI Council. Copy of the PCI DSS is here, and it says, tells you all the things that you're supposed to do here. How to sell, and then we click again, an actionable framework. Requirements, etc. PIN requirements, point-to-point encryption. Oh, we don't get to see it until we actually agree to something. Oh, it's a license agreement. Okay, I think I accept on behalf of the entire institution. So now we can take a look at it. Is this the right one or is that the changes? Okay. So what is it that this self-regulatory document says? What do they have to do? Build and maintain a secure network. Protect cardholder data. Protect stored cardholder data. Encrypt transmission of cardholder data across open public networks. Use and regularly update antivirus software. Develop and maintain secure systems and access and applications. Restrict access to cardholder data by business need to know. Assign a unique ID, restrict physical access, all these best practices, track and monitor network. So let's go back, right? What was it that the FTC said BJ's had not done? It said it had not encrypted stored computer information. Well, here we go. Encrypt transmission of transmitted data, encrypt stored data. Stored information for up to 30 days, even when it no longer needed the network. Et cetera, et cetera. And on and on and on. You see the parallels here. What the FTC was saying, BJ's hadn't done in 2005. By when did we hear PCI had begun? This recent one was 2007. I don't remember what it was, but it was early on. So around then, right? 2007, I think it was. These were the standards. Tracking, these are the best practices. Concern about in transmission, not doing as they do at the hacker convention, right? Not getting up on the wall of shame by putting your credentials in the clear or putting credit card numbers in the clear. Once they're received, not storing them without encrypting them. While they're sitting on the hard drive, encrypt them. Parenthetically, if you are personally interested in encryption as a tool for your various sensitive things, one thing to look at is TrueCrypt. TrueCrypt is TrueCrypt.org. It is a free open source disk encryption software for Windows, Mac, and Linux, for which you're allowed to make a donation. This is a phenomenal tool. It is free. It is easy to use. You download the Windows or the Mac version or whatever, and you can either encrypt your whole hard drive so that you have to put in a passphrase, or you can create a file that is basically a virtual hard drive that just sits there unreadable. Unless and until you put in your passphrase. Your passphrase can be an entire sentence. I mean, it's not just a password. And while it's sitting there, it is encrypted not to 40-bit standard, not to 128-bit standard, but to 256-bit standard, which is a lot. There are some interesting things here. So what is this useful for as a consumer or as the lawyer? Well, consider systems like Dropbox. Or consider your thumb drive that you walk around with, like mine. Thumb drive. You might want to walk around with sensitive documents, but you don't have to walk around with them easily read. What you do is you take Proofread. You put it, put the program onto your thumb drive. It's very small. You put different versions. You can put the Mac version, the Windows version, the Linux version. And you have a file that is in that is a TrueCrypt encrypted volume. You know what? I should probably show you how this works. But you know what? I may show you at the end of the class if we have time. So essentially, you're walking around with this unreadable file and the program to read it. You go to any computer, put in your thumb drive, you run the program, you put in your phrase, suddenly you can read your files and access them. But they're not stored on the computer. When you're done, you walk away, no record of it, your document is secured. You're looking confused. You have no idea what I'm talking about.
No, I actually am trying to think
Okay, no, it's fine. That's why I'm telling you, because this is probably the easiest way right now. This is industry standard. It's open source software, which means not that it's easy to break, but the algorithms, the actual methodology of encryption, has been looked at by a lot of people who know this stuff, because they could read the source code, they could read the programming, and say, yeah, it does what they say it does. So here's... You could use it in your office. They have to be careful, right? Because who's using it? Is it the company using it and the company keeping track of the passphrases? Or is it employees? Imagine, not you because you're all professionals, imagine your disgruntled office mate. Here's he or she is about to be fired. Installs TrueCrypt, encrypts everything, and leaves. You're not breaking them, unless your office happens to be the NSA. At that point, the severance negotiation becomes very interesting.
What's the comment? I'm wondering. Is it a comment?
It might be. It might be...
Conversion?
It could be conversion. It could be considered... accessing without authorization and causing damage, which might be a federal cyber crime. Right? Exceeding authorization. It could be theft. It could be extortion. It could be a lot of things. It's certainly not a good day at the office. So, you know, just as, well, with great power comes great responsibility. Just as nuclear power, you know, this is a powerful tool. How could it be used properly? Very easy. If you have any information that is sensitive, that is stored on portable devices, it should be encrypted, whether you use this or anything else. Laptops should not leave your office bearing sensitive data that isn't encrypted. So that if the laptop is lost or stolen, no one can read it. But if the employee needs access to it, it is the matter of 30 seconds to put in the passphrase, and suddenly those data are as if they weren't encrypted at all. That's how you use it. So if you have mobile employees, or data going on thumb drives, or on smartphones, or sitting in cloud storage somewhere, this tool allows you to have additional control over the security, regardless of how lax the owner of the holder of the laptop, the user of the smartphone, or the manager of this cloud storage service is about its own physical and electronic security. Even if people break in, they can't use it. That's why file encryption is so important. That's why, among other things, what PCI says is don't keep anything you don't need. Right? What did the FTC say about BJ's? In violation of bank rules, why was it that banks said don't keep the credit card numbers longer than you have to? Because the longer you have them, the more easily they get stolen. And who is on the hook for stolen credit cards? Not debit cards. Who's on the hook for stolen credit cards? Who's on the hook? Who eats the cost of a stolen credit card being used? Is it the cardholder? Of course it's the bank. It's the issuing bank. Debit card's different. That's why I say don't use debit cards. Bad idea. Many fewer protections. It's your money that you have to come back. No. Credit cards are the issuing bank's money. You're protected under federal law up to $50. That's it. The bank eats it. So the bank says to BJ's, don't keep the credit cards. Why would BJ's need to keep a credit card on file? You walk in, you give a card, you pay, you're done. Once that transaction has cleared, they don't need, BJ's does not need those credit card numbers anymore. What about returns? Well, you have to show your credit card and get a rebate or refund on the credit card you used or a different card, get a gift card or whatever it is. You don't need it. Absent, maybe sometimes you do, but absent a need, best practices, PCI guidelines, bank rules, and FTC strong suggestions backed up by enforcement. Don't keep it longer than you need it. Don't take what you don't need. Don't keep what you need longer than you do need it. And encrypt it while it's sitting there. Yeah.
Aren't there stores nowadays that just like call stuff to the door and tell that sometimes you don't even need your card to come out for the returns because they have the longer system?
Right. Yeah. So, yes, they do. Yes, they can. The question is that permissible? Don't know. Don't know whether they've encrypted the storage or they're just bad about it. Kohl's, I drove up and back one day to Boston, to Brandeis in Waltham yesterday, and I passed TJX. And I was thinking about this class because TJX, which is the parent company of Marshalls and TJ Maxx, was the victim of one of the largest credit card thefts, data breaches in history. So I'm driving by, like, I should take a picture, it's relevant. But the issue is they're retaining the credit card numbers when they don't need to. Yeah, I do, I have seen that. They scan it and you get the refund. It may be that after 30 days or whatever the period is, you would have to show the card, I don't know. Sometimes you have a card on file. Online retailers, much more likely because you're not showing the card. But there too, best practices are that they are stored in an encrypted fashion so that the retailer basically has to decrypt them in order to charge them. We don't know. One of the things that has happened in electronic transactions as a result of in terms of data protection, is what is on a credit card receipt. Anybody have a credit card receipt with you? No? I'm trying to think if I have one in my wallet or something. Probably not.
I have the one from the cafeteria.
Okay. I'm going to confidently walk over, steal it from you. I'm not going to hold you eight. Because I am confident that I cannot steal your credit card number. Because all it says is 1857. Those are the last four digits of your card. See? Didn't used to be that way. What? Right. And before that, of course, right? You made an imprint. The reason that has changed is because of things like PCI. that the credit card processors have been obligated not to print full numbers on receipts. That changed. We also get state laws. Interestingly, we don't yet have general, I mean, you know, we've got the FTC, of course, but we don't have specific federal requirements overall of encryption yet. So just as, and we'll talk about it in a little while, data breach notification laws, the states have stepped in. And notice, anyone want to hazard a guess? Well, I told you already. The home state of TJX? The Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Is it any wonder that Massachusetts has led the nation in passing regulations for the protection of personal information of residents of the Commonwealth? Notice this. This law, this regulation applies to any organization, any person in the legal sense, who owns or licenses personal information about a resident of Massachusetts. It establishes minimum standards to be met in connection with the safeguarding of personal information contained in both paper and electronic records. What does it say? So first thing is duty protect. Every person that owns or licenses personal information about a resident of the Commonwealth shall develop, implement, and maintain a comprehensive information security program in terms of what it should be doing. Great. Every person that owns or licenses personal information about a resident of the Commonwealth and electronically stores or transmits such information shall include in its written information security program the establishment and maintenance of a security system covering its computers, including any wireless system that, at a minimum, let's look at the minimum requirements, shall have the following elements. Secure user identification protocols, controlled user ID and other identifiers, a reasonably secure method of assigning and selecting passwords, control of data security passwords, kept, restricting access to active users and active user accounts only, blocking access to user identification after multiple attempts to gain access. So here is issues of identifying the user, make sure passwords are minimum standards of security, number of letters, it has to have letters, numbers, symbols, it can't be your last name, it can't be the last five passwords, all those annoying things. And then secure access control measures, restricting access, assigning unique identification plus passwords that are not default passwords, encryption of all transmitted records and files with personal information that are going across public networks, and encryption of all data to be sent transmitted wirelessly, reasonable monitoring of systems, encryption of all personal information stored on laptops or other portable devices. For profiles containing personal information on a system connected to the internet, up-to-date firewall protection, patches to the operating system, antivirus, and education and training. Every person who owns or licenses personal information about a resident of the Commonwealth shall be in full compliance with this regulation on or before March 1st, 2010. You know, just as we saw in looking at consumer privacy, that whether we were talking about the original best practices or whether we're looking at the Data Protection Directive or any other discussion of privacy policies, we kept seeing the same concepts. Concepts of permission, concepts of disclosure, of access, of redress, right? These standard bullet points for best practices, that you should disclose what you're going to collect, that you should get consent from the user, that you should allow the user to correct any errors, right? All those concepts. Here, too, we see the same themes, don't we? PCI, FTC, Massachusetts, over and over and over again. Access restrictions, physical and electronic. Need to know, need to see. Access restrictions as far as locking, passwords, good passwords. Antivirus software, firewalls. Encryption in transmission. Encryption in storage. Control over data that are stored on portable devices. Control over data that are being sent wirelessly. These are our best practices. And they're not only a good idea, as the old t-shirt said about, 186,000 miles per second, it's not just a good idea, it's the law. Is it speed of light? This is not just a good idea anymore, it is the law. Now, when was the last time in a class you heard the Massachusetts rule? Right? Pieper doesn't tell people about the Massachusetts rule, he tells people about the New York rule. Why are we talking about Massachusetts' rule? To whom does this regulation apply? What does that sentence say right there? What does it say?
Every person who owns a license is personal information that is registered in common law.
Okay. So, Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center gets an application from one of the four potential law students who came and talked to me yesterday at the law school fair at Brandeis, which is why I was there, who are now living this nice young woman, freshman. Don't ask me why she was thinking about law school yet. Very nice woman from Medford, Massachusetts. Let's say in the fullness of time, she's ready to apply to Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center because I really, I got to her. She sends her application to us. This rule applies. We're not in Massachusetts. But she is. She is, not even if she is or isn't in Massachusetts, she is, as defined, a resident of the Commonwealth. Her personal information must be stored. All of your companies, to the extent that any of your customers or suppliers or anything, any other name you have in your databases, happen to be of people who are residents of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, you are subject to this regulation. Anybody complying with this yet? Well, how do you know you have to be? Why do you have to be? Why does Touro have to?
It just, in my mind, I wonder if it's truly enforceable as they would hope it to be.
That's where you get the issue. Similar to the requirements in California that every website collecting data from California residents must have in its privacy policy, the little California privacy policy disclosure. Are they enforceable? Don't know. More to the point, they're going to choose their targets the way that HIPAA, HHS chose its targets. But to the extent that your organization has potential exposure in Massachusetts, bank accounts there, right? An affiliated organization there, I'm sure there's some Touro institution in Massachusetts. They're everywhere. The fact that this is a local law doesn't matter. This is the internet. You are getting data. So this becomes the de facto standard. Whether or not it's enforceable, any more than California will and can necessarily go after every website holder, even in the United States. But the fact is, it's potentially enforceable, and it's not asking a lot. It is essentially embodying the same best practices that PCI contractually does with all credit card processors, and that the FTC looks to consumer to protect consumers from avoidance of. There it is. Now, is it enforceable, this type of thing, overall? Let's find out. Let's look at this case. First Circuit case from last month, Anderson versus Hannaford Brothers and Cash and Carry Food Stores. What's this claim? Plaintiffs appeal from a dismissal of their main state law claims arising out of the unauthorized use of their credit and debit card data after hackers breached the electronic payment system processing system of defendant Hannaford Brothers. So setting aside the data breach issues, district court determined the plaintiffs failed to state a claim under Maine law for breach of fiduciary duty, breach of implied warranty, strict liability. It wasn't considered unfair trade practices. But note that what this court does here is reverses the dismissal of the negligence and implied contract claim. So here what we have is a potential enforcement of negligence and contracts because this business allowed unauthorized access to 1.4 million credit and debit cards, it says here. Oh, I'm sorry, no, those were cited cases. So how was this done? It seems that this was not inadvertently misplaced or lost data. The data were stolen from this vendor, and you have a contracts claim. So it isn't just, it seems, that consumer protection agencies have authority here, but at least potentially, there's a private right of action for allowing this to happen in Maine. And what if it does? So we see it's fairly clear what the best practices are, and they may be imposed by statute or regulation, as they are in Massachusetts. They may be imposed by contract, as in the case of PCI, the PCI standards, or they may be effectively imposed by the potential liability for failing to do it. Consumer protection, breach of contract, negligence, state tort claims, etc. Whatever the driving force or forces, these practices appear to be fairly established. But what if, whether or not, well, that's an interesting question. What if they fail? Or what if there is a breach? What happens then? Here, too, what we have is a developing body of law and regulation and best practices with regard to preventing data breaches, or at least identifying potential factors, and responding when they happen. And this, as I said at the outset, this is a much more recent development in terms of legal obligations, but it's coming up because we keep seeing these cases. I think in my introduction, the first day of this class, I went through my list, my partial list from May 2007 of reported data breaches from universities, from the Transportation Safety Administration, from banks, from all sorts of technological businesses, one after the other after the other. The ChoicePoint case settled that month. ChoicePoint was really the first time we saw these laws in effect. The problems, the breaches are becoming more prevalent. They are affecting more people. I certainly have gotten notices of potential identity theft, potential breach. Yes? No? Anyone here have a Steam gaming account? Right? I think we looked at that last week. I told my son, change your password. I don't know if he did. So they're happening. And when it happens to citizens and it happens to legislators, we get laws. We're still, part of the effort is to focus on the potential problems, not just the affirmative obligations that PCI has in terms of encryption, but did you see the other part? Beyond the technical and access, physical access restrictions, what was it that Massachusetts required first? What does it say? Every person in the resident shall develop, implement, and maintain a comprehensive information security program that is supposed to identify the problems. Highlight where the holes might be. Identifying and assessing reasonably foreseeable internal and external risks to the security, confidentiality, and or integrity of any electronic paper or other records containing personal information, right? So this is not about specific techniques. This is about risks. Where might we have a problem? What are we doing that opens this up? Are we taking credit cards? Do we have databases? Are there outside databases we don't control? Do we have employees? Do we have temps, contract workers who have access to this stuff? And so on. But also, when the unthinkable, well, clearly it's not unthinkable, we're planning for it. When the bad thing happens, when there is a breach, either an affirmative breach by a malicious hacker or a disgruntled employee, or an accidental breach due to, an applicant for a job for an advertising agency working with your billing company who takes the spreadsheet and posts it on a tutoring site to try to figure out how to do a pie chart, or hard drive, laptops get left in a hotel, or phones get lost, or Blackberries, or devices, whatever it is, what do you have to do? By when and to whom must there be notice? I said a few minutes ago, that the concern here is, what if, even if you've taken the precautions, bad stuff happens? That's actually not such a simple question. Because as it turns out, many of the state data breach notification laws, the laws that mandate reporting to victims when bad things happen, only mandate reporting if the data were not encrypted. Even in those states that don't require encryption affirmatively, they effectively strongly incentivize it by saying that if you haven't encrypted the data and it's breached, then you must disclose. So there's a strong incentive to encrypt because it means you don't necessarily have the same level of disclosure obligation. So we don't have a formal data breach notification federal statute yet. There are bills. There have been bills for the last few years. Maybe we'll get one. Meanwhile, 40-plus states have their own data breach notification laws. I have a little book from the ABA in my office that lists them. And if you go through it, you'll see that they generally fall among a few standard models. California's, New York's is like California's and so on. But then you have the FTC. And the FTC has gone about this in a really interesting way. So we don't yet have a federal statute, but again, the FTC has this mandate. So what has the FTC done? What the FTC has done is passed the red flags rule. And you think about what a red flag is, right? I don't mean necessarily any red card in football, but a red flag, you know, problems might happen here. So what the FTC has said, for all businesses that maintain ongoing billing accounts, any company, any organization that keeps your billing information, your credit card, your payment information on file because it will regularly rebill you. Like what? What kind of companies do that? Cable, absolutely. Telecom service providers, right, allow you to just automatically pay your bill. Cable companies, merchants, magazine subscriptions, auto-renew. Anybody allowing you not to give your payment information, Land's End, etc. All of those companies are subject to these rules that require ongoing audit, self-auditing of potential identity theft red flags. That's the hook here. This is about preventing or at least reducing the incidence of identity theft. But nobody's doing it. Nobody is doing it. The red flags rule, as opposed to the red flag rules, it's kind of like a Midsummer's Night dream. The red flags rule was adopted years ago, but enforcement was delayed again by the FTC for a very simple reason. Nobody knew about it. The FTC did not want to have a rule that it was required to enforce when it was very clear that the vast majority of businesses subject to this federal regulation had never heard of it, were not ready to do it. Sure, the big telecom companies know about the red flags rule. The big service providers know about the red flags rule. Don't they know it's still class time? Bothering you with that little page or buzz. But many, many organizations don't. And so this is one of those things that's on the books, but the FTC is not really doing it. Instead, they're trying to do education. It was very funny. If you tracked the extensions of enforcement of the red flags rule, so you would have 3 months, 3 months, 3 months, and then at one point it was, We're now doing an education program because we're extending it. Hold on, I got my, where's my red flags rule? Oops. Open. Yes, I do want to open that file. I heard a click. Is it open? There it is. Here's our red flags rule. Originally effective January 1st, 2008. The mandatory compliance date for this rule is November 1st, 2008. No, it's not. Because it was extended and extended. And so if you look at the rule, you have to go through, right? It talks about the different kinds of reports, etc., that are obligated here, but it's about notifying people of the red flags issues, or rather, going through your organization, making sure you've done all your self audits, etc., and continuing to go back and doing all these things. Let's see if we can see this. Okay. Hold on. Yeah, so here, FTC was, remember, it was supposed to be in October 2008. It was extended until August 1st, 2009. And then, right, here's May 2010. The FTC is further delaying enforcement through December 31st of 2010. And so on, while Congress considers legislation that would affect the scope of entities covered by the rule. So you see, there are all these extensions. Who is covered? Financial institutions, so here's... So you see, but they just... Oh, here we go. And finally, a change in the law... On December 18, 2010, more than 2 years after this was supposed to go into effect, amended the definition of creditor and limits the circumstances under which creditors are covered. The new law covers creditors who regularly in the course of business meet one of three general criteria. They must obtain or use consumer reports, furnish information to consumer reports, or advance funds to or on behalf of someone, except for expenses incidental to a service provided by a creditor to that person. So now, right? So you have financial institutions and creditors. So it hasn't avoided, so we have anyone else who directly or indirectly holds a transaction account. It's still there, but they had to cut back on the creditors. We're still, you don't see a lot of enforcement because it's still unclear. So how do these laws work? Basically, what they say is when there is a breach, under whatever circumstances the law requires, notice must be provided to consumers. But because these are state laws, notice must only be provided to those consumers in those states whose laws have been triggered. When the Choice Point data breach happened, the only reason that the world heard about it was because California had a data breach notification law. And California residents got the word that some people had fooled Choice Point into handing over all these consumer records. Nobody else got notice. Luckily, people in California weren't that secretive about it, and the word got out. Now that's less of a problem because we do have all these different state laws. But for your clients, you have to actually do the research. So what have we learned today? What have we learned? What must your clients do, and your employers, in advance if they are storing personal information about consumers? about individuals. What have we learned about what they must do or what they should do? Right. All those good best practices, whether through PCI or FTC, ultimately the Massachusetts law, those are the points. And if your client pushes back, you can point to the Massachusetts law. You can point to the BJ's case. You can point to all these things saying, you can point to the Hannaford Brothers case in Maine. Whether or not you, client, are specifically subject and exposed to a particular law, right now, it is very well established these are the standards by which you must run your operations. Not just financial information, personally identifiable information about consumers, about anybody, about individuals. And we have this issue of the red flags type self-monitoring. Always a good idea to identify potential risk places and try to address them. And in response to a breach, you need to look at the relevant states, whether we have a federal law yet or not. You need to look at any contractual obligations. Both of these, right? There may be contracts that obligate disclosure. There may be contracts that obligate, like PCI, protection. These issues are everyday questions, and most of your clients will be out of compliance, are not doing the best practices. So you need to be prepared for the second part of this, in terms of risk assessment, and be ready, and they need to be ready to address not only the legal requirements, but as we saw in that case, that article from the UK, the reputational requirements. If your client is lax about its data, it will not look professional. It will not be trusted in the same way, whether by a lender or a consumer or a strategic partner. Those are risks that have cost to them as well. It's not just about legal risk. It's not even about financial cost. You've got reputational damage too. Questions? All right. Have a happy Thanksgiving. And safe trip home before that. Be careful. It was getting awfully cold. There might be icing out there.